Grace from the CSC, and welcome to our first podcast episode. We're here today at the top of the BMO Tower located on Bay Street. CSC just moved in, and we opened up our podcast studio, our very first podcast studio. And I'm here today with Miranda Wurschik, and that's how you pronounce your last name?
That's absolutely correct.
Good. Yep. And Miranda is the Senior Vice President at IBK Capital. Miranda, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Grace. It is an absolute pleasure to be here for the first podcast, the inaugural podcast from the BMO Tower. Yes, I have been working in resource mining finance for 25 years at IBK Capital. It's been quite an interesting ride, let me tell you that. I come from a slightly different background from your typical investment banker. I have a biology degree, an anthropology degree, and then I have business on top of that. So I'd like to think I bring a slightly different view into the resource finance world.
Great. So I've known Miranda for probably, it's been 5 years?
5 years,
Yeah. And I call Miranda the pink of the resource sector because when I was in London, England, I just see, like, she looks exactly like Pink, if anyone doesn't. I'm going to throw up a picture of Miranda on the screen so everybody can see that she looks like Pink, and she has the energy, just amazing energy, and, you know, I dubbed that name in London, England when I saw you kind of very
running across the conference floor.
Yeah.
my electric blonde hair standing straight up.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where you can find her. And I actually saw in your bio that it was like excited personality or something in your bio. I was like, yep, they nailed it. Excellent interpersonal skills. I'm like, yeah.
Well, and those kinds of things, you have to kind of, you know, be very calm, cool, collected, right? But it's certainly the one dimension of me is very different from the three dimension of me.
The three dimension of you. So, Miranda, I wanted to talk to you, what is it like to, you have over 25 years experience at IBK Capital.
Yes.
And so what's it like to work there for 25 years? I mean, millennials, we kind of jump around, that we're known for jumping around from job to job. I mean, within 3 years, but 25 years, like what is that like?
Yeah, so, I graduated from my second degree in 1992. So I had an opportunity at that time. I sort of moved around, got my toe in the water in a couple of finance jobs, and I ended up at IBK. It's a small family-run private investment bank. At that time, there were 6 people in the office. And so I joined a team who was quite unique in funding early-stage resource opportunities. The beauty of working for a small firm like that is that you become a family. Right. So I've grown up with my president. I've worked with him for 25 years, side by side, the chairman. Obviously, people come and go, but I've remained there for 25 years, and I have had the opportunity to grow into the person that I am today as a senior vice president. It's been interesting through multiple commodity cycles, market crashes, bull markets, bear markets. I have to say I've got a lot of support. Being a small firm, it's easier in some ways to get your boots on the ground, right? And I've had good support to do that.
That's excellent. And when you first started IBK, did you see that ladder? Like, you were like, I can really kind of make something of my career here.
I think so, because we were so small, and there was so much opportunity to carve your own path. I am unique, I would say, when I started as a woman in finance in this business. I don't think there's a lot of us, but there are many who have sort of toughed it out over the last 25 years. And I really saw an opportunity where I could create my own brand within the IBK brand. And I worked towards that. I worked towards that.
Great. Yeah. And did you ever, when you were there as a woman in finance, did you ever see any of the issues that are talked about today about kind of women in finance and how they're treated, or
You know, it was 1994 when I started at IBK, so you know, there my mom's an academic, career academic, 50 years in academics. She talks about all the issues. My aunt was an engineer at IBM and talked about the issues. I don't, you know, those have been around for a very long time. I think you just have to really work hard and try to manage yourself and manage your opportunities. Obviously, yes, they were there, but you just have to keep your head down and keep focused. Right?
Yeah, yeah, no, I see that. I give the same advice. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what, I'm always in a room with only men, and I, you know, some of my girlfriends will say, well, what, don't you feel like you're, you know, different than them in the room? And I always say, I just don't see myself like that. Like, as long as you can do your job and do it well, and you know what I mean? It's just, it does happen, obviously.
We've all experienced uncomfortable situations.
Yeah.
For many years, I was the only woman in the room. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of work in Europe, so somewhat of a unique commodity there as a woman in these meetings, road shows, presentations. But, you know, you continue to put your head down and focus on the job at hand.
Yeah. Is it different, the different feel in Europe than here?
Yeah, I think the vibe there is a little bit different. Maybe, I hate to say, sort of slightly more old world. but you know, I think when I was in London at Minds and Money in December, I was on a panel about diversity, and it's not just diversity of gender, but of all groups of people, of ethnicity, of LGBT, trying to bring a more diverse workforce into the mining business. And those conversations have been around for a long time, and I think people are finally starting to pay attention and move forward on that, because it really is, at the end of the day, the best person for the job. Yeah. Right? You really have to focus on the best person for the job. But yeah, I mean, you and I have both faced probably some interesting conversations and situations. So, but you just, you always take the high road, you act gracefully, and you just continue to move forward.
Yeah, exactly. And would you say, you know, with being in this industry in the resource sector for over 25 years, would you say that you're doing what you love?
Yes. I am a really good people person. Mm-hmm. I am loud and noisy, and for lack of a better word, I am really good at engaging with people. Some people have even gone as far as to call me a unicorn from that perspective, in terms of networking and connecting people. And I don't know where that came from. You could probably talk to my mom and say that it was a fairly loud, noisy child who just kind of marched around in a full-blown Sagittarius mode. But I really like what I do, and I like the people that I meet in this business. They are my friends, and I have the opportunity to travel the world and meet people, new people each and every day. And I could probably land in any major city and know people and call those people friends of mine through the business, right? Which is, I think, a huge blessing, and it really is a gift to be able to do that kind of work.
Yeah, no, I always say finance is a great industry to be in, because you meet people from all lines of work. It's not just focused on one sector. And, you know, one time I was at a resource conference and I met someone who owned like a vineyard and was just like talking to me about wine for like 20, 30 minutes.
Never,
and I was like, cool.
Never know who you're run into. We were on a site visit in Colombia. This was 10 years ago. And one of the guys that came down owned the largest dairy farm in California. And he somehow was interested in mining. And he was extremely articulate, extremely intelligent. And we were stomping around a project in Colombia.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Draw any parallels there, unfortunately.
But to your point about meeting somebody
who
owns a vineyard,
exactly.
Right? Just you never know who's going to be around the corner, and you never know the people you're going to meet. Right?
Exactly. So just I wanted to a lot of the reason why I wanted to talk to you today, other than your vibrant and, you know, personality, I wanted to also talk to you about you taking an active role in finance advisory assignments. So your recent highlights include working with Cobalt Blockchain, a junior company focused on building a metals trading business in the DRC to source conflict-free cobalt and other minerals. But for the topic of for the conversation today, I just want to talk mostly about cobalt, because when I started at the CSC, I have to do a lot of research before I talk to speakers, and one of the things that interests me was cobalt being a conflict mineral. So you're kind of working with this company that is using proprietary blockchain-based traceability platform. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So cobalt blockchain is an absolutely amazing opportunity. We started working with a company in late 2017. We had a relationship with one of the principals through a gold company that we had worked with here in Ontario. They had set up a private trading business in the Congo to trade the 3Ts, tin, tantalum, and tungsten, under ITSCI, which is effectively a paper-based trading system. They came to us because they had started to look at some cobalt opportunities, artisanal scale operations in the Congo. And the price of cobalt at the time had skyrocketed from, you know, demand. EVs were starting to really pop up into people's radar. Cobalt, lithium, graphite, nickel, all those commodities were starting to ping on people's investment horizons. So we set about trying to get some activity and work going with them. Cobalt blockchain was created through essentially a reverse takeover of a shell. It's a public company listed on the TSXV, and what they wanted to do is to look to source cobalt, ethically sourced cobalt out of the Congo, out of these artisanal scale operations. Several years ago, there was a report put out by Amnesty International highlighting and documenting child labor and other issues at artisanal scale sites in the Congo. So children digging for cobalt. You know, these sites are they look like beehives with
this is the first time I've heard of artisanal mining, right. And when I was at PDAC, they were telling me, you know, that they leave holes in the ground, yeah, because they don't know how to clean up after the mining.
There are pits dug, you know, down 30 meters down. There's no safety around it. You know, they are digging with axes and picks. There's no environmental conversation or discussion. It is like bees on a beehive digging cobalt out of the ground, right? Wow. All of a sudden, with a new generation of people and the Apples and the Googles and the Samsungs of the world looking, saying, wait a minute, we're actually putting this material into our batteries, right? Where is it coming from? How is it getting out of the ground? Is it responsibly sourced? Is there a supply chain traceability? How do we make sure that the commodity that we're getting at the end of the day, so from mines to market, is responsibly and ethically sourced? There are initiatives out there, Fair Trade, Fair Mine, which look to put parameters and guidelines around sourcing these materials. The OECD has a five-pillar approach to responsible mineral supply chains, right? So there has been a huge push forward to look to how do we put structure around the supply chain, right? So cobalt blockchain wanted to take a look at these artisanal sites and then use technology, which I think is going to be a key driver in building sustainable businesses, mining businesses going forward, for traceability, an immutable record that cannot be changed, so from mine to market.
Oh. And so is this a new idea? Now, I don't just mean the technology, but the focus on the sustainability around mining. Do you think that this, when you first started in this industry, is this something that's like new that you're hearing about?
Yes, absolutely.
Taking interest?
Absolutely. Okay. I think through 25 years, you know, we've had when I started, there was a particular way of doing business, right? Mm-hmm. So companies would go in, they would do their initial work, exploration, development, production, right? But we have to know that land isn't ours, first of all. It doesn't belong to the company. It belongs to local indigenous people, local groups. It's owned by private landowners. There is a whole social, environmental ecosystem that surrounds these mind signs. So you're looking at communities, you're looking at the environment, socioeconomic status, health, education, all those variables, and there's many, many more to try and look how do we go in and actually do business in a sustainable, professional manner that engages all stakeholders. Right. Yeah. So it's not just you know, shareholders of the public company or private company that benefit, but you have to go in at the very beginning with those conversations now, because you need to talk to the communities, you need to talk to the people, you need to understand what kind of physical environment or ecosystem you're working in. Anthropologists, sociologists, biologists, engineers, all these people need to be involved in order to build what I think is a sustainable business going forward. You can even look at it as like a building a social enterprise around, yeah, especially if we're talking about artisanal scale operations, that these operations are unstructured in some ways. Some are structured by co-ops, but many are just two or three people working on a site, right?
Right.
Day-to-day existence, right? So how do you translate those operations and put technical structure around them, put financeable structure around them, right? So, and then land, okay, how do we ensure that this is responsibly sourced, right? The whole concept of responsible mineral supply chains, right?
Yeah.
And so we know that there's no child labor. There are no pregnant women digging in those pits, right? So we're trying to build better businesses and better mining businesses going forward, I think.
Yeah, one of the things I learned about artisanal mining at PDAC was they were saying that one of the most effective ways to kind of stop artisanal mining is to educate them, you know, local people on what they're doing and how, and you know, the importance of like cleaning up after mining, and so how do you think that you're gonna teach locals about this blockchain technology? It is a very complex concept.
That's a very good question. I mean, I think artisanal mining has been around for centuries, mm-hmm, right? So people working the land to extract metal for livelihood. You know, artisanal operations are a good place to start for a mining company, because many of those have been producing for decades. You don't have any quantifiable resource per se, but you know that year over year they produce 10, 12,000 ounces of material, whether it's gold or silver or whatever the commodity is. It is a huge process of education because you know, there have been incidences in Latin America where they use mercury for gold extraction, and it's caused huge environmental issues, right? So getting people on the ground to work with these communities and these groups out of the gate is a huge task, and it's a huge challenge, right? I mean, it's how do you deploy enough people to get on the ground to be looking at cultural differences, you're looking at cultural ecosystems, you're looking at can men actually talk to women, can women talk to men? You know, there's this whole other side that you need to think about, that you can't just drop in somebody and go, we're going to teach you about blockchain today and this is going to solve all your problems. That's not the way to do it, right? It's going to be a long, very finite, specific process of education for these people, because at the end of the day, and we talked about this in a conversation I had with a group called the Artisanal Gold Council, is that, you know, really people just want to make it better for their children. So the next generation, how do we make things better so our children aren't doing or functioning the way we function today? Right? So there's a real focus on improving lives today for the next generation. And that, you know, that's all we want to do, right, is make it better for our children and their children, right? So that was a very compelling conversation to have for people that have been on the ground at some of these artisanal sites globally, that it's, we just want to make it better, right? And how do we do that, and how can you help us do that within our cultural structure, our cultural reference points, You know, the environment we work in, all that is critical. It really is critical.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess their initial instinct would be like that you guys would be a threat to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you know the older model is that the companies would come in. We're just going to work the ground, right? We're not going to really necessarily have conversations with people, but today, if you are doing any kind of exploration, you have to engage with those local communities. All the local stakeholders need to be involved and have conversations. I mean, we did work with a company, Junior, in Colombia 10 years ago, and before they even set foot on the ground for any sampling or anything, they held town hall meetings with all three local communities. They Amazing. Sat down, they said, this is what we're looking to do. We're going to do a census of all the people. We're going to do a health survey of all the women and children in the communities. We were going to hire local geologists, which they did. And people think this costs a lot of money, but it didn't.
I was just about to say, do they allocate a certain cost?
They were a junior exploration company with a limited budget. Wow. And they said, this is what we're going to do. So when we went down for the site visit, we were not strangers. We were not told to go away. There was no animosity. It was a very fluid conversation. And they hired local geologists, and they took care of the local people, and they built a school, and they looked after people's health and welfare. It was 10 years ago for a junior company to do that was incredible, to be honest. And that project just started production in the Northern Miner last week in Colombia.
Wow. Okay, so you think that they're going to be like a staple example for other junior mining companies?
I think so. I think it's people. People need to talk more about what they're doing and share. Hey, we did this on the ground and it worked. Or how did you find that? Did that work for you? You know, I've been to the IFC Sustainability Exchange. I've, you know, spoken with the OECD. I've spoken at IMOR, Art Mines Money, around all these kind of topics about building sustainable mining businesses, right? And what does that look like? What does it mean? What do we need to do, right? And people are very good at keeping the information to themselves when we really should be
telling people
and sharing how we had successes, right? And also sharing, well, this didn't work, why didn't it work, right? So I really think we need, the dialogue needs to be bigger and broader. And it's the smaller companies, too, that are a little more nimble sometimes, that can get things done. They may not have the budgets to do it, but they made it work. And it went a huge long way for building that company over a decade.
Are you finding that, so a lot of the focus, too, with millennial investors, everyone's asking, where are millennials going to invest? How are they going to invest? I'm reading a lot about how millennials kind of are looking towards investing in things that are sustainable. Are you seeing this affecting investors today? Like, they're looking for, oh, how are you, mining sustainably?
I think so. I mean, I have two young daughters, youngish, and the 17-year-old has asked me multiple times, where does the stuff in my cell phone come from?
Hmm.
Right? What does it look like? How does it get out of the ground? Who's pulling it out of the ground? Right? And she's 17, so the group ahead of her, those questions have already been asked, right? And so the resource business has to be able to be answering those questions, right? And so we talked about blockchain technology, for traceability and immutability, right? A record that cannot be changed, distributed ledger, input all through the supply chain market, right? So you've got a record of that commodity. There are groups, there are artisanal groups, tracing gram by gram what's coming out of the ground, right?
Wow.
Because refiners want fair mined product, right? There's a shift on the gold side, people looking, Responsible Jewelry Council, where's your gold coming from? Refineries, where's the gold coming from? Is it sourced ethically? Is there some way to prove that's been sourced ethically? We really, I think, need to look at, technology and innovation to build these sustainable businesses of the future. I mean, at PDAC, I had a chance to wander around the trade show, and just look at what kind of technology and innovation is out there, because I think the business has been criticized, right? Yeah. That we don't innovate very quickly, and we are slow to make those transitions. But, you know, MindSense, a company out of Vancouver, doing some very cool work on real-time geology.
Yeah.
We talked about blockchain traceability, DLT Labs, Blockhead Technologies, MindSpider, right? Protocols already in place for traceability. There are mine processing groups, right, that are out there with new technology to look at processing. A company out of New Zealand called TrueScape, looking at 3D visualization of projects and sites, taking complex data and translating it into a very easily understood 3D visualization, where you can adjust the variables. You can look at sensitivity analyses and go, oh, okay, that's what it looks like. That's what the mine's going to look like in 10 years and 12 years and 15 years, right? So some really phenomenal innovation that I think will make a difference on how we build our business going forward.
Do you think that was a big topic that was discussed at PDAC this year, was innovative technology? Is that another angle people are looking at?
I think so. You know, and PDAC is it's 26,000 of your best friends roaming around Toronto.
Yeah.
and one
resource pink.
It's certainly, if you look to the groups like the Minds and Money groups, they have a Minds and Technology stream, right? Yeah. So they really are in parallel to the Minds and Money, so the money side of it, because nothing can happen, we all know, unless you have capital, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is where we come in, right? We raise the capital for companies to be able to execute, right? But the technology, we're going into places we've never been before. We're going deeper into the earth. We're mining lower grades. We need to be able to figure out how to do it better. We need to look at health and worker safety. How is that impacted? Communication underground, productivity. How do we improve productivity? So, you know, the Minds and Technology guys are looking at, okay, what kind of really cool innovation is out there that will allow us to do that? And I think if you build technology and innovation with smart, capable teams, we will be able to get into, you know, building these sustainable businesses and taking into account all stakeholders.
Yeah.
Right? Like
it's just one big circle.
One big circle, right?
Yeah.
So not, you know, not looking at it as independent little pods of people, but making sure everybody's connected and everybody's on the same page right from the start. Right? Because it's far better, we all know this, to be proactive than reactive.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? No. So if we set the stage and set the groundwork out of the gate, I think it's gonna be much better for the business.
Yeah. Yeah. And lastly, just on this topic, why did you choose this project to work on?
Which the
blockchain.
The blockchain.
Yeah.
I think we took a look at it as a unique business model, right?
Okay.
A small junior company using technology and innovation to make a difference, right? To make a difference, because all, you know, the majors have the capacity. You know, Goldcorp and Yamana, De Beers have traceability systems that they're working with, you know, blockchain based, but, you know, specific to cobalt and artisanal scale operations. You know, they are unique. They are unique.
Right? Yeah. And do you see, I mean, I was reading a little bit about this project and they're saying that cobalt will be of a deficit in 2023. So do you see any other minerals that they could be using for electric vehicles?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of conversation about the battery composition, right? So nickel, lithium, cobalt, graphite, what are the specific percentages that you need? I think if you read recent articles, information, we're a ways off in terms of phasing out cobalt. Cobalt adds stability to the batteries.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to take a lot of research, energy, and intelligence to find the right chemistry. I mean, we're always interested looking at opportunities obviously in the nickel space. We've looked at graphite, lithium. We've done work in copper, gold, silver, right? But, you know, with this real push into the electrification of the world, mm-hmm. And not just car batteries in terms of, you know, storage batteries, big batteries for power scale, right? You know, it's a huge shift, right? And we need to figure out where we're going to get those commodities.
I had to say electrification, you know, the other day on camera, and I was like, imagine saying electrification 10 times. Do that. 10 times.
Say electrification.
Yeah, no. And you're like, what?
It would be embarrassing.
It would be too much. And so I just want to briefly just, I saw that you, you know, with your busy work schedule you've got your extracurricular financial assignments, Cobalt Blockchain, but also I noticed that you're a member of the Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada, the Canadian Institute of Mining, and you're also vice chair of Women in Mining. Can you tell us a little bit about, especially the one, your experience being the vice chair of Women in Mining? That's
right.
Pretty cool.
So that's been, you know, I've been in this business for 25 years. I joined Women in Mining Toronto probably about 12 years ago, just to go see what it was all about. And I met some phenomenal women who are still some of my best friends today, really trying to bring together women in the business to talk about what we do, how we do it, how maybe we could do it better. I had kids, came back and forth, but then I came back to it a couple of years ago thinking, okay, I've been in this business a long time. How can I, with my experience and knowledge and network and wisdom and all that, get involved? So I actually joined WIM UK. So I'm a member of WIM UK. I'm also a member of International Women in Mining, and became co-vice chair of WIM Toronto last year because we really wanted to reframe women in mining in Toronto to look to bring together women in this business to connect, share, and inspire. Right.
Wow.
So that is our motto. Right. So how do we continue the dialogue? How do we lay the groundwork for the young women coming, like yourself, coming behind us, right?
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 25 years. Hopefully I'll be doing it for many more years ahead of me. But how do we create an environment where ideas can be shared? How do we open doors for people? How do we create those paths for young women in a male-dominated industry? And I'm not going to stand up and wave a big flag and tell all men to go away, because that's unreasonable, and it's the way of the world. We have to coexist, right? We need to figure that out, but how do we make this industry better for younger women, and how do we support, you know, with my experience, how do I share, how do I mentor people to come into this business and be excited about this business, because it's phenomenal people, and it is literally 2 degrees of separation, right? So that was my my vision. Plus, I have 2 daughters. So how do I try to lay a path for them to show, yeah, you can work. You can do anything you want, right?
Yeah.
You can work in any business. You're capable. You're smart. You can network. You know your stuff. So Women in Mining was for me in Toronto a small microcosm to be able to start to make affect some change, right?
Right.
And the luncheons and things we do are really focused on
connecting
and sustain. We talked about sustainability. We've talked about building the mine in the future technical work, right? So we really try to bring in a broad range of people to talk about all the bits and pieces of the industry, right? And they really are a great networking opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And we have our spring fling in May,
ooh,
our end of season kind of gathering, right?
Oh,
where we you know, try to get 120, 130 people out just to network and chit chat. Right?
Yeah, no, it's important to have those, and it's important with these, you know, these female-led groups that we're not just focusing on negative things that happened, or, you know what I mean, that we're focusing on positive things, trying to make change, trying to break new ground.
Exactly,
together.
We're not, you know, bashing people. We're not.
Yeah.
We're really trying to look forward and trying to talk about issues to demonstrate that we have capacity and capability.
So Miranda came into our office today, and she was very excited to show me this quote. So I would like her to share it with us today.
Well, thank you, Grace, for this opportunity. It's been phenomenal to have this conversation with you today.
Yeah.
I just wanted to sort of close the loop on the whole conversation, because we ended, you know, we were talking about women in mining. And I came across this quote, which is actually put up by a friend of mine on International Women's Day last week. And I think it really applies to, as I said, women as the conscience of the mining industry, and how, you know, with us involved, we can help drive the business forward to build sustainable social enterprises. So here's the quote. The world becomes a better place when women are its caretakers, leaders, and visionaries. We must be mindful of and honor the immense power of women to improve humanity and protect our future. I think we can drive the mining industry forward with this kind of vision and strategy to build the business of the future in the mining industry.
Great. Well, thank you again. And me and Miranda are going to get out of here because it's hot in here.
Yeah. It's a little toasty.
Get a little toasty.
Yeah. Thanks, Grace.
No problem. Bye.
Bye.